Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
Hey, everybody, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Today on The Breakdown, with record numbers of new coronavirus cases in both California and Florida, we'll hear how the two states managed this pandemic so differently.
That's right. It's an investigation Marisa joined in, actually, with the investigative team at Reveal and WLRN in South Florida. And then we're going to be talking with Nicole Gill. She's co-founder of Accountable Tech. They want tighter controls on political misinformation spread by social media companies like Facebook and Twitter. But we begin with Divided States of the Pandemic, that special investigation with Reveal, KQED, and WLRN in Florida, South Florida, I should say. And joining us is WLRN's Katie Switalski. Katie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just, you know, the two of you, and I'll start with you, Katie. Tell us a little bit of, you know, about the reporting you did. What were you looking for and what did you find?
Oh, man, we were looking for a lot. We wanted to chronicle the very beginning of how leaders at the state level and local level in both California and Florida started to respond to the coronavirus and sort of, you know, who made those early decisions? How effective were they? What can we learn from them? And what we ended up doing was chronicling the whole beginning of March, really, into April, and seeing what that told us about the how the rest of the pandemic's playing out.
And Marisa, you, of course, talked with people in the Bay Area, which was really the first region in the country to mm-hmm. lock down. What did you, I mean, we lived through that here in California, in the Bay Area, but, you know, what did you learn that surprised you or impressed you?
I mean, I think the biggest takeaway, and we should step back and say, like, this is one of the most bizarre reporting experiences I think both of us have ever had, because we're still in the middle of this. Like, we didn't know until, like, right before we went to the show a few weeks ago what our findings were going to be. And they're changing even now because we've seen these upticks again. But yeah, I think, Scott, like, having been here and, like, you know, I'm sitting here broadcasting from my garage and I've been doing that for a while now. It was really fascinating to fully understand how much in the Bay Area, the public health officers, without input from politicians here, used the power that they've been given under state law to implement that shutdown, how that led to mayors then coming along, and then the governor a few days later issuing the statewide shutdown. And I think common thread between the two states, and there's a lot of differences at the top, but was this idea of kind of how something that can be a double-edged sword in American culture, which is the individuality, the culture of individuality, actually led to a lot of, at least at the beginning, of people to make their own choices to protect themselves. And so we saw both in Florida and California, like, people stayed home even if they didn't necessarily get told to by their government. Here we did, obviously, in the Bay Area. But I think just like that idea that people at the Chinese hospital here were leading the charge early on, even before March and when it was clear what was happening in Wuhan. And, you know, in Florida, the same thing. You had business owners shutting down and just saying, like, hey, we're out, you know?
Yeah. And Katie, of course, here in the Bay Area, California generally, we have a very robust public health system. And as Marisa said, you know, it really is controlled by the counties. What about in Florida? Is public health as big a deal there as it seems to be here, based on, you know, what you saw and heard from the reporting that Marisa did?
It's definitely a big deal here, but it's also run very differently. So we have one statewide Department of Health, and they have an outpost or a branch office in each county. And really, those counties all have to answer and go through the state office. So there's really no independence, and you don't see public health officers here out at press conferences. They're acting much more behind the scenes and advising the politicians here. And that's across the state and in South Florida. And it's really become really interesting to see how much of this has fallen on local leaders, and yet everyone still needs blessings to do things from our state capital in Tallahassee. And I think that's one thing that we saw in California too, which ultimately the point of this investigation shows how much of this was left to more local governments.
And that's like ironic, right, Scott? Because we often think about like Republicans being more down with local control and Democrats wanting centralized power.
When it's convenient, yes.
Yeah, but it's the opposite in these states. And I do think it's like important to see. I mean, Newsom's been out front on a lot of this, but the county's really led and he followed.
Yeah. And I don't know if either of you really know the answer to this, but Reveal chose Florida and California. They could have chosen two other states. They could have chosen Texas and California or Georgia. Who knows? But do you have a sense, Katie, of why Florida was chosen? I would imagine because they were expecting to see a real contrast between the two.
That was what we expected to find out in the beginning of this investigation for sure. But with about half the population of California, Florida and California really started to see some of their early cases, first deaths around the same time. So we kind of had very similar beginning points. And yet in terms of shutting things down and responding, California was about two and a half weeks ahead of us. So we were trying to look at what was that gift of time going to do for Florida. And really what we expected to find was that contrast. But what we ended up finding was up until, and now of course this has changed, but up until we released the show, our numbers were relatively similar, and they stayed similar despite the difference in approach initially.
What are they looking like now?
Florida is massively spiking. We've had our second highest daily caseload today, and our highest caseload, 5,500 cases, was yesterday. So we really are struggling with that local control now, and a huge patchwork of mask orders that differ based on what city and what county you're in. And certainly we're seeing it, you know, South Florida really had the most of the cases when this all began because we're the densest area of the state, but we're also seeing other parts of the state really spike. And now we're looking at hosting large events like the RNC in Jacksonville.
Yeah, I want to come back to that and ask you about how people are feeling about that in a second. But Marisa, here in California, yes, the Bay Area really took the lead. You know, L.A., the mayor down in Los Angeles was also very out front on this, although, as we said, it's the counties, not the mayors, that really have the power on all this. But, you know, what are you seeing today? I mean, you know, yes, rates are going up in Florida, but that's happening here as well.
It is, although to give a little context, and part of the problem with this reporting and continues to be the problem with this story is the data is really messy. We don't, like, we know what we know, but we don't know what we don't know, those unknowns, right? So, but just like on a very simple math issue, Florida has half the population here. You just heard Katie say they just had their highest day of cases reported, over 5,000. We just had about 5,300 reported in the last 24 hours, according to the briefing you just covered, Scott. So, like, yes, the numbers are bad here, but they are not as bad per capita as they are in Florida. And I think the other big difference in this exact moment, and of course that could change, is that our hospitals are still doing very well here. We're not seeing those high percentages of COVID patients kind of overrunning ERs. And in Florida, Katie, I think that's a pretty different situation right now, right?
We are really concerned about different hospital capacity. And the state has actually started, just started, requiring hospitals to report ICU beds differently. So instead of the state of Florida coming out and saying, okay, now we know publicly that, you know, there's XYZ many people in ICU beds in hospitals, now we just want to know how many people are receiving quote unquote intense level of care. So we're seeing the state kind of strip back on some of the specifics, especially when it comes to hospitalizations.
Well, and that kind of brings me to your governor, Ron DeSantis, who is a Republican, of course, and very close to President Trump, unlike Gavin Newsom, the Democrat out here, who has also been avoiding criticism of the president, mostly because we need the federal government. But I'm wondering, Katie, are Republicans in Florida sort of having second thoughts about, you know, sticking so close to President Trump and, you know, his disdain for masks and that kind of thing?
We haven't seen that yet. And certainly while people in Duval County around Jacksonville are looking in more and more polls like they're not excited to hold the RNC, as far as the rest of the state is concerned, there's a huge faction of Floridians that really do. They're against wearing masks. They are on the governor's side. And now we're seeing that support for Governor DeSantis wane a little bit on social media and trending on Twitter with hashtags like DeSantis resign. But he still has not seen crazy pushback from other Republicans about masks, about changing up his strategy, because he is a very close political ally of the president. And they do have regular conversations about coronavirus multiple times a week.
And Katie, there have been reports, NPR, I think, did some reporting that really called into question the data, the accuracy of the epidemiology and the diagnoses and the number of cases and all that in Florida. What do you know about that?
Yeah, that's a concern. And it's a concern because we've had an employee of our State Department of Health come out and basically blow the whistle that the State Department of Health wants to change the numbers and wants to make it look like Florida's ready to reopen and is asking people to manipulate the data. So there hasn't been a good light shed on that and transparency. And there's been a big push ever since the pandemic began to push Governor Ron DeSantis and to push the state to release more data, to talk about the numbers more openly, and to give those numbers the important context. But like Marisa said, if we found out one thing, if we're certain of one thing after reporting on this in the middle of the pandemic, it's that the data is really, really messy and almost meaningless without that context.
Well, and in that regard, Marisa, you know, the governor today here, Gavin Newsom, his announcement of an open source platform with all the data, mm-hmm. inviting mathematicians and Nobel Prize winners and ordinary citizens who are just curious to dig into the data and, you know, see if there's something that they find that might be helpful. Does that seem crazy to you, you know, having just come out of this big data collection project and kind of wondering what it all means?
I mean, it seems like a heavy lift, but it's a step in the right direction. And I think we have to like give Newsom credit for doing this while also acknowledging that at the beginning of this, when we started reporting, there was a lot of challenges in getting the state to give us data here as well. So I don't think there's been as much of a sort of public effort to suppress the data as we're seeing in Florida and continue to see with like what Katie's talking about of changing the method for accounting for ICU beds. Newsom's talked a lot about, you know, the importance of things like the percentage of people testing positive. And I think that's another really interesting data point is like here in California, he's worried because that percentage has inched up from around 4.8% to a little over 5% in recent days. And Katie, I think you told me this morning that like you guys are like five times that in Florida, right? So he is definitely like, you know, more interested at this point, at least, in putting out that data. But there's definitely been some struggles to get it.
And that's our daily, our daily percent positives has skyrocketed along with our spike in cases. So much so that our court system in Miami-Dade County reversed and rolled back some of its reopening.
Wow. Let me just ask you, Katie, how hard was it to do this reporting? I mean, how cooperative, you know, was the governor and the different health department folks? I mean, did you have to, you know, how hard did you have to push to get the information and the access to them?
Well, I learned a lot about California because it was really interesting to see the California team actually get to talk to public health officials and to, you know, look at things like that, where here we ended up emailing questions to the Department of Health and to the governor and were met with varying levels of non-responses. So when we asked the Florida Department of Health, you know, in great detail, what is your strategy for combating the spread of the coronavirus? We basically got an answer back that said, we are being strategic and methodical. And so it's those kind of obstacles that really, yes, we've got a public data forum, but when people are questioning that public data forum and we're trying to dig into the basis of these early decisions and who is making them and what effect they're having on the spread of this virus, that becomes quite difficult.
Yeah. Well, let me ask both of you. I'll start with you, Marisa. We're still in the first wave, I think, of mm-hmm. this pandemic. Is it too soon to say just how these different approaches the two states have taken and are taking to this pandemic, you know, what difference that's going to make?
I think it's not too soon to say that we know, and it is clearly the most blunt instrument, but we know that shutdowns did work, right? And we saw that again in the data in Florida where people just chose to stay home even before they were told to. And it did help, it seems, suppress cases. And I think a lot of research is backing this up. I think what we don't know is how the different approaches as we reopen, and let's be clear, as in California, suddenly the science-driven decisions of the early pandemic are being really muddled by political decisions and pressure, how that's going to play out. And I think, again, we expected to see spikes here, Scott, in recent weeks because of the protest. But the truth is a lot of the counties outside of LA that are seeing really, sharp increases are not places where protests were widespread. Riverside, San Bernardino, even Fresno County. And so I think that is going to raise questions again about, does it make sense that Newsom has stepped back and let counties lead as we reopen? Is there going to have to be a hammer, as we're seeing actually happen in Republican-led Texas right now, where they're backing off of some of the reopening? But yeah, it's like you said. I mean, Mark Galli at the State Department of Human Services, who oversees all healthcare in California, told me a few weeks ago that we're in the bottom of the second inning. So I think, you can't call a game in the second inning. So I think there's a lot left. And I hope Katie and I are going to be continuing to kind of compare notes as this moves forward and see what we find out a year from now about these approaches.
Oh, I hate baseball analogies when the season hasn't even started yet. It's just, Katie, the last question to you then, what is your takeaway in terms of, is it too soon to say what difference this is going to make in terms of the different paths Florida and California have taken?
I think it's really a question about reopening versus shutdowns. And so it was easier to look at these decisions and see the effect that decisions to shut down made in their timeline. The murkier, much muddier part of this comes with the reopening and how, yes, shutting down, especially in Florida, was super piecemeal. And it all happened in different localities at different times with different, orders. But at the same time, it was at least easy to measure those definitive actions. And now that reopening is so gradual here, we've had we've had a huge problem with people at bars, and now Broward County, where Fort Lauderdale is, we can shut restaurants down if we see that there's not social distancing or there's crowding at bars and things like that, which was not something that we had last week. So the reopening changes so quickly, and I think we're going to see that difference play out in this huge battle between politics and economics with public health.
Yeah. All right. That is WLRN's Katie Switalski. Thanks to you for digging into all that data, along with Marisa Lagos from KQED and Reveal. And by the way, you can go to revealnews.org to find that podcast. It's called Divided States of the Pandemic. Give it a listen. Very much well worth listening. All right. We're going to take a short break right now. See you, Katie. We're going to take a short break. And
when we return,
we will be joined by Nicole Gill. She's co-founder and executive director of the new watchdog group called Accountable Tech. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Rund Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. And we're joined now by a co-founder and the executive director of a new group. It's called Accountable Tech. They're pushing for tighter controls over Facebook and Twitter as the election nears. Nicole Gill, welcome to the Breakdown.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, looking at your website, I'm just quoting here, it says that you advocate for the social media companies at the center of today's information ecosystem to strengthen the integrity of their platforms and our democracy. What does that mean? What are you trying to do?
Yeah, it's a lot of words, right? So Accountable Tech is a new organization, like you mentioned, that's dedicated to combating online misinformation, deception, and manipulation. And essentially, you know, we have a social media system in this country and across the world where a handful of tech giants who are largely shielded from both regulation and liability are the modern gatekeepers and curators of information. But these companies are first and foremost businesses. So their responsibility is not to citizens or to public service. Their responsibility is to their shareholders. And that has dictated their decision-making policies. So for example, we're focused quite a bit on Facebook. And Facebook derives 90% of its revenue from advertising. And so what they've done is created really excellent products and algorithms to maximize engagement so that they can sell more advertising. And research even from inside Facebook shows that their algorithms and the way their system recommendations are set up inherently rewards outrageous content, you know, reinforces biases, and filters people into small echo chambers where they only see information that confirms beliefs that they may already have or furthers beliefs that may not be grounded in the truth.
So, okay, so we know this, right? This is in the ether. Mark Zuckerberg or Trump maybe are the, you know, 800-pound gorilla in the room here, the elephant or whatever you want to call it. But, I mean, what could you guys do about that? Like, we know that in 2016, the Trump campaign spent $44 million on Facebook. They plan to spend more than that now. It seems like, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing at the time around Russian and foreign interference. Now we're seeing Facebook become even, like, more, I think, of a conservative platform in a lot of ways. But to your point, that's their business model. They're not going to want to, like, anger their customers. So what does success look like for you guys as an outside group, given these are private companies?
Yeah, so we are certainly focused on actions that the companies themselves can take, although keeping in mind that really regulatory and legislative action is probably what's ultimately necessary. So let me just give you an example. Facebook has pretty strong community standards and rules around voting misinformation. And in the past month, President Trump has posted several statements to Facebook that call into question the integrity of vote by mail, that claimed an action that the Secretary of State in Michigan took to mail ballots to registered voters was illegal. Both of those things violate their own policies, yet Facebook has done nothing about them. So those posts spread, you know, wide across the platform. Meanwhile, Twitter, in comparison, has started to label some of these posts. So you're not censoring, they're not taking the posts down, but it limits the amount of engagement that can happen with them and kind of instructs users to maybe find out more information about what the president is claiming in his tweets.
Yeah, and that raises a question. Like, as you said, Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, taking a very different course from Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. Do those companies have different agendas, either politically or, you know, just in terms of their business models?
Well, I certainly can't speak to Jack and Mark's, you know, political leanings. But what I will say is that Twitter has, over the past few months especially, and I would go back to starting in the fall when Twitter announced that it would no longer allow political advertisements on its platform. They have taken actions that demonstrate they understand their role in this information ecosystem. Facebook, on the other hand, likes to maybe address problems when they become PR problems, but does not take proactive measures to limit misinformation and fraudulent content on their platform. So they've certainly taken different models in their actions.
I mean, what do you think, from the outside, understanding you're not having coffee with Jack and Mark, although I like that you call them by their first names, like, what is that about? Because, you know, Twitter for a long time was a lot more targeted, one, because of President Trump's reach there and the fact that he seems to find it his main communication platform, but also because beyond Trump and just, like, political, politics of partisanness, you hear a lot about harassment on Twitter, about sort of bigger issues. And I'm just wondering if they're kind of like getting a little bit of a pass right now because, you know, they have stood up to Trump, which makes the left happy. But it doesn't seem like they've dealt with some of the other things, whether it be harassment or, you know, bots and Russia and foreign interference.
Yeah. Twitter is no angel out there, right? Like, Twitter is still.
Have they been accused of that? I don't think so.
Sure. Every day I spend on Twitter is kind of, you know, angelic. Like maybe I'm taking away part of my lifespan. But I think at the end of the day, where Twitter has taken limited action, Facebook is just, they're just not motivated to do this. It's not in their political interest. It is not in their business interest. And so until it becomes a business imperative, they are going to happily keep going on business as usual. The only kind of caveat to that, I would say, is that the activism in the last month or so has shown that there's dissent even inside the company, which is really interesting to see. Facebook employees actually starting to speak out about some of the decisions.
And does that matter?
And walking out, exactly. Yeah.
But does that matter? Yeah. Like, do you think that, because explain, I mean, I think in some businesses that may not make a huge difference.
I think Facebook is a company that has a certain ethos. It prides itself on doing good and bringing communities together. But ultimately, their product is only as good as their engineers. Mm-hmm. And those engineers have choices. They have other companies they can go to. They could use their skills to perhaps work for organizations that are combating some of these things. And so, I mean, look, a couple hundred employees walking out or signing a letter is perhaps not the biggest stance in a company that has somewhere around 50,000 employees. But it's more than ever has spoken out before.
Yeah.
And so if you're seeing that many go public, we know that there's lots more inside the company that are just not willing to do that yet.
Yeah. Nicole, we've got a couple of minutes left, 3 minutes left, but I want to ask you, we're a few months now away from the November election, so much riding on the outcome of that. What is your biggest fear and the biggest fear of your organization, Accountable Tech, in terms of what could happen around the election in terms of misinformation, mischief that might be, you know, tried by, you know, actors either inside the country or out?
Yeah, so I'm much more worried about action taken by bad actors from inside the country than outside at this point, largely because a lot of domestic actors have picked up the tactics that Russia used in 2016, for example.
And do we know who they are?
In some cases, you know, there are some misinformation networks that you can kind of track across the platforms. But they're also, you know, smartly kind of disguising themselves or changing the names of groups, things like that to kind of stay under the radar. But back to your question, I think the biggest concern we have at Accountable Tech is this proliferation of misinformation around the election. So things like voting by mail being fraudulent, and therefore people not taking the election result at face value, whether, you know, whatever outcome it is. We've also seen, and there's quite a long history of, and the Trump campaign did this in 2016, of misleading voters, particularly African Americans and those in swing districts, on where their polling place is or what day they vote. So, you know,
that's
deliberately
so cynical.
Trying to.
Yeah. Wow. It's just amazing what lengths people will go to screw
there's
things
no,
up.
There's no low. Yeah.
All right. Nicole Gill, Executive Director of Accountable Tech. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. That does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer is Katie McMurrin. KQED's leadership team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Jonathan Blakely, and Erica Aguilar. I'm Maurice Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at mlagos, if you go there.
If you go there, go there. Go ahead and go there. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer. We'll see you next time, everybody. Stay healthy.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.